Judge Rodenberg, Chief Judge Cleary, Judge Bjorkman, the Honorable John R. Rodenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's my understanding we're having a little trouble with the microphones this morning. Is it recording okay?
Yep. The sound levels are just a little low.
Okay. So speak up if you can. I'm a little hard of hearing in one ear, so maybe you can speak extra loud. And if you see me going like this, it's because this ear works better than this one. The first matter on the calendar is State versus Sims. It looks like both counsel are here and ready to proceed. There'll be 15 minutes principal argument for each side, and of course, appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish to use that time. Whenever you're ready, you may proceed. The podium is adjustable as well. There's a little toggle switch beneath it somewhere. I wasn't directing you to change it, but it looked like it might be a little low for you.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Mishick, and I represent appellant Trajan Sims. Mr. Sims was convicted of one count of marijuana possession in the fifth degree with intent to sell. On appeal, he's asking this court to reverse his conviction because of insufficient evidence. In the alternative, he's also asking this court to reverse and remand his case for a new trial based on two jury instruction issues, and also based on the fact that an officer testified to a legal conclusion that the intent element was met in this case. For the purposes of this argument today, I would really like to focus on the three fair trial issues, and then if time allows, move on to the sufficiency arguments. The first jury instruction issue I want to address is when the district court instructed the jury on a particular order in which to consider the counts. This was plainly error. It was clear from cases of Pertin and Davis that a court can't instruct a jury that it need not consider lesser counts if it finds the appellant guilty of the higher count. That's exactly what happened in this case. So there was error. Both appellant and trial counsel, defense counsel, and the state objected at trial. The district court ignored both of those objections and stated, well, I think this instruction's actually got an appellate review and I think it's fine. From the cases I found, that's not true. And so I think it's clear that there's error here. Really the question is how was my client harmed? There was harm here. And because there was an objection, I'd note that we're in a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So to affirm, this court would have to say, only if it could be said beyond a reasonable doubt that the error had no significant impact. It did have an impact. We know that the jurors most likely did not consider counts 2 and 3 because a jury verdict was not rendered. It wasn't brought back. There was not a guilty or not guilty. So with the harm aspect, we know from Pertin that part of jury deliberations is evaluating whether or not a lesser included or a higher offense is more appropriate. The court says that such considerations may cause the jury to evaluate the evidence differently as to an essential element. Now, here, what could have happened was the jury could have started with count 3 and determined, well, we like maybe possession here has been met. They move on to count 2. They might analyze the possession element different with if they went in a different order. And they might have ended up at a different result here. So the other thing that courts look at with harm in this aspect is when courts give a complete and proper instruction, but then later on indicate an order, they say that usually there's not harm. In this case, there wasn't a complete improper instruction. It was count one, the elements were listed, and then there was these verdict options at the end. So I'd ask the court to also look at an unpublished case called State v. Johnson that I cited in my brief on footnote 5 on page 24, where this court actually reversed and remanded. And I'd note that that was the only case that had the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard, and that the court reversed in that case. If there's no questions on this issue, I'd like to move to the second issue, the jury instruction issue. So again, there was error in what happened here. This is under a plain error analysis with the weight threshold issue.
Is that, assuming that there's error in that instruction and that it's plain, as it seems to me a strong argument can be made, does it really make a difference in this case where, given the expert's testimony about her, the weight she determined and the margin of error, so to speak, the fact that, you know, there's testimony that these this weight was accurate to a 95% probability. I mean, where's the harm flowing from this plain error?
Right. The harm, I think, is the expert testimony from the BCA analyst. She testified that she was 95% confident that that it was within a 0.005 margin of error. So there leaves a 5% chance that it was outside that margin. Here, the drugs were only 0.193 above the threshold. So within that 5%, you know, it could have deviated out either less or more. And the harm here is the jury could have actually said, you know, we're gonna give the state this, and we think it's 42.5 grams on the dot. I mean, it's in the instructions. The number's clear on the instructions. And then they would have found Mr. Sims guilty. But unfortunately, the statutes don't allow that. It doesn't allow them to find him guilty of a felony.
Getting back to what's the significance of the 95% testimony? I mean, if the testimony is that I'm 95%, that this weighing was 95%, accuracy. Isn't that proof beyond a reasonable doubt in terms of proving the weight? And so doesn't that suggest that the error, the plain error, is harmless?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think, you know, 95%, you know, it's tough to quantify proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think the jury could have had a reasonable doubt as to the weight here. You know, hearing the testimony, they said, well, there's a 5% chance it's outside here, and the weight's really close. So I don't think just that number would create proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
It seems like the 28 individual baggies were weighed separately, and then the values were added together to reach the 42.6 or whatever the number was. Am I right on that?
You're right, yeah.
Was the sum total of the marijuana ever weighed together?
I'm almost positive no, and I'll correct that statement. I'll check the record very quickly, but I'm almost positive what happened was each one was weighed individually, and then it was an aggregate amount, and I think they actually call it an aggregate amount.
It was kind of close here, and this is a little bit of a follow-up on the questions asked by Judge Bjorkman. I mean, if we had 10 pounds of marijuana and the judge gave the same instruction, I think we would probably agree that that's harmless.
Sure. I don't think I would even brought this issue, right?
Well, or 5 pounds or 1 pound. Where's the point, though, where, you know, if the expert is 95% sure, at what point do we say, well, it really is harmless because the evidence would have supported it?
You know, I'm hesitant to give like a number, you know, as far as the percentage and as far as how much deviation. I just think in this case, we're within the reasonable doubt, this gray area. I mean, it's, you know, 5% is significant, and the jury could have sat there and said, you know, I think it's exactly this amount. And I don't know if
there's no testimony that it was exactly that amount, though.
No, there's no testimony, but what the nature of the weight testimony is, you know, the weight analyst isn't saying it's exactly this amount. The weight analyst is saying, based on my scientific method, here's the measurement I got, and I'm 95% confident it's within this range of margin of error. So it's more of a probability that it's exactly that amount.
She also said, did she not, that each bag was approximately 1.5 grams and that there were 28 bags, and that would be 42 ounces, correct? It would be below the level.
Did she testify? I am not aware of that.
She said the person, each bag contained approximately 1.5 grams, typical amount for street level sale, and that there were 28 bags. And on the surface, that's 42 grams, right?
Right. So that there, I think the jury then could have taken that, you know, and said, well, we have some doubt based on that testimony, right?
The plain error, we sometimes forget the plain error, the prong that says, yeah, even if you got error that's plain, that affected substantial rights, it's still a situation where an appellate court intervenes, you know, if it's necessary to ensure the integrity. I mean, when you have an error that in some ways is this plain, where it seems like the judge just misread the statute and the instruction, and yet nobody in the courtroom said anything when it was so clearly wrong, wouldn't that suggest that this isn't one of those cases where even if their error is plain, this court should step in?
No, I disagree. I think the fairness and integrity of the judicial proceedings, I think under that prong, this court should intervene. Because, you know, Mr. Sims could have, the jury's finding could have been exactly 42.5, and that should be a petty misdemeanor. And based on that finding, Mr. Sims has a felony on his record when he actually should have a petty misdemeanor, or if they found a petty misdemeanor, right? So I think just the fact that he has a conviction that's a felony is huge, and I think the court should intervene based on that. I want to move on to the third issue, the expert testimony issue. Again, this is a plain error analysis. There's some question about if we're in plain error, harmless error. We brought it as plain error because I think our objection, our take on it is slightly different from defense counsel. If this court wants to agree with the state and apply harmless error, we're obviously not going to object if you think that the objection below is broad enough. However, I'll proceed under the plain error analysis. Rule 702 allows expert opinion in the form of expert testimony in the form of an opinion based on specialized knowledge. Really, the touchstone is helpfulness to the jury. The courts have decided that it's not helpful for an expert to testify on mixed questions of law and fact. Here, what happened was the witness went over a line that was set in a case called Collard. In Collard, the expert testified, the police officer testified that possession of $500 worth of drugs would, quote, indicate to me that this is more than what an individual in his own use would have. The court in Collard found this to be not very conclusive, not a legal conclusion, said that's okay. And then it's cited to an Iowa case called Ogg, which was for the opposite proposition and when an officer sort of steps over that line. In Ogg, the officer testified specifically to the LSD in this case, and it was more of a conclusive legal statement. And here, the officer crossed that line in Collard when it's on page 27 of the transcript. There's a back and forth about the amount of drugs typical for personal versus sale use. And the prosecutor asked the officer, in your opinion, was this marijuana packaged with the intent to sell? And the officer said, in my opinion, in my personal opinion, based on my experience, yes. That, I think, is plain error. It crosses that line clearly.
Because packaging with intent to sell is, you say, the same as possession with intent to sell.
Right, yes. And because of, basically the clear implication that the intent element here is met. I mean, this is like the doctor in the case Moore I cited, where the doctor says the person's injuries constitute a great bodily harm. You know,
that was the loss of a tooth case.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is the witness basically saying the intent element here is met. And you know, again, this is, I know this is a plain error analysis, but the harm here is strong. There's a lot of harm. There was not much evidence on intent in this case.
I don't know about that. It seems like the jurors would have figured that out with or without this testimony. 28 small little packaged bags. I don't know. I think that testimony was largely irrelevant.
Well, I disagree. I mean, I think jurors, we shouldn't assume that jurors know, you know, what's sale versus not sale. You know, it's possible also that Mr. Sims bought this the way it was.
It's possible.
And beyond the the packaging was key here to the state's case on intent. There were no ledgers. There were no, you know, cell phone texts. There's no controlled buys. There's no large amounts of cash. There's not, you know, tons of amount of drugs. So really the state is relying on this officer to establish intent. The officer said, yes, intent's here, and then the state used it in its closing argument. So I'd ask for this court to reverse Mr. Sims' conviction and in the alternative reverse and remand on these fair trial issues.
Okay, you will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you want to use that time.
Okay.
Ms. Jenny?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Linda K. Jenny. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota. Well, I will start with the issues in the order that appellant's counsel started with them. It's the state's position that the jury instructions in this case did not constitute prejudicial error, as I said in my brief. This case can be distinguished from the cases cited by appellant as to directing the order in which the counts should be considered, because in addition to telling the jurors that they need not consider the lesser included if they find that the greater is met, the court also explicitly told the jurors, and I have this on page 15 of my brief, that she told them that you're free to consider the issues in any order you wish. I have not intended by anything I have said to indicate that you must consider the issues in any particular order. So this case...
So it was confusing instructions in your
One might
mind.
Say that, but what it is it's different from all the others. You've got, just as in a fact situation-based case, this is a different fact situation. I don't know that it's exactly confusing, but she's saying you can consider these counts in any order in which you choose. And then she goes on, she's trying to be helpful, and says, if you find that he's guilty of this, you need not consider this.
But in doing
so, a reasonable juror would conclude from that they ought to start with the one?
I'll leave that up to this court. It's possible, I think.
That does suggest, at the very least, that you can make your task simpler by looking at this one. And if you find this one, then you don't have to do this other work.
Well, the other way of looking at it would be that she also said you can consider them in any order you wish, so maybe they did start with the lower ones and then go up. We don't know. We don't really know what they did.
Then why wouldn't they have returned verdict forms on the lower counts?
They may have interpreted her language to mean we only need to bring in one guilty verdict, if any. We don't have to deal with the whole thing.
But in any case, the state objected.
It did. And as to the second part, the 42.5 grams, yes, that was an error because, as this court knows, a small amount of marijuana would include 42.5 grams.
You concede that it's error, and I think you concede it was plain, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're only talking about harm.
Whether it affected his substantial rights. I will point out that I think even appellant's attorney misspoke and I know he did, but I don't have the cite here, in a conversation with the judge where he talks about the 42.5 grams. It seems like everyone there was confused about this 42.5 grams, and it is easy to get confused on that point. Nonetheless, 42.5 grams is a small amount, as this court knows. But I'd point out that the expert said she was 95% sure of her weighing of the 28, the marijuana. She took it out of the package, obviously. And it came up to...
She took it out of the package.
The little 28, each one. She took...
Did she ever weigh the entire amount together?
I do not recall. I was going to look it up when you asked, but I didn't want to create a ruckus. But I...
We appreciate that, because that seems like that sort of would have been helpful to the state if you had one piece of testimony saying, and then after I got done with all of that, I put it all on the scale and it was 42.69 or whatever the number is. I didn't see that anywhere.
Well, in any case, even if she didn't weigh it all together, she weighed each amount, and she came up with a total of 42.693 grams. And then she said, so, I mean, it's the state's position that it's largely irrelevant whether she weighed it all together or added it up. In any case, she came up with 42.693 grams. And she said that the margin of error was 0.005, and anything, and only slightly, it would only slightly, her word, slightly, differ from the 0.005. And I did some math last night, and I'm not a mathematician, of course, but it seems that 0.005 is, you'd have to get to 42.5 grams, it's 37.6 times bigger than 0.005. So it's not slightly, it's 37.6 times. In other words, 0.005 times 37.6 is that differential.
But it's close, and the difference in a case between felony possession with intent to sell conviction and petty misdemeanor, that's pretty significant. Doesn't that enhance, if you will, the prejudice flowing from this error?
It is what it is, Your Honor. It is the difference between 42.693 and 42.5 with a 0.005 margin of error. I cannot deny that. Well, my reading of her testimony was that she was 95% sure it was accurate, but with a 0.005 margin of error or slightly different from that. And as to the expert's testimony, a close reading of his testimony, well, first, I agree that the defendant objected to the police officer as being an expert. He did not object to that particular line of the police officer, so I agree that this should be reviewed under plain error standard upon review. So she's testifying, and she says, typically, if you have a decent amount of marijuana that's packaged into these little amounts, typically that indicates to me, based on my training and experience, that they have an intent to sell. And she says, typically they're requesting one large bag when it's just for personal use. And then at the end, she says, yes, in my personal opinion, based on my experience, yes, as to the question about intent to sell. So
why didn't the prosecutor stop after she testified they have an intent to sell that marijuana? I mean, rather than emphasize it by asking what is a jury issue and an element of the crime.
That would have been a better practice, Your Honor. I agree with that. But even given this, I think that the jury, the province of the jury would not have been invaded because the jury would have known that what this officer was really talking about was what has she seen typically as an expert in her field. I think it was inartful, but I don't think it was prejudicial.
What evidence was, other than this officer's testimony, what other evidence was offered on the issue of intent to sell? Other than the fact that the marijuana was in 20 individually wrapped baggies, which I think was undisputed.
20 individually wrapped baggies, and then the quantity, of course, itself would have been there. Let me look. As to the intent to sell, well, it was the state's position that Mr. Sims possessed the item both individually and jointly, and of course there was a scale and a gun found in his passenger's purse, so that would go to sale. Other than that, I believe the packaging and the quantity would be what did go to sale, because of course they didn't observe him actually selling.
I want to go back to that. How does the possession of a handgun by someone say anything about whether they do or don't intend to sell marijuana?
Well, you raise a good point, Your Honor. I know that there is a vast amount of case law which suggests that certain items do go hand in hand with the sale of drugs, but this juror may not have been aware of that case law, and there was no testimony to that point, so I will agree with that. They may have inferred it, or they may not have.
That seems to me to be the answer to the question. It was largely a circumstantial case, wasn't it?
Yes, I mean, as to intent to sell.
Eight little bags, they're in the thing, they're in a backpack or in another package behind the seat. It seems like it was a circumstantial
case. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I will, in that vein, point out that I think this case can be distinguished from the State v. Harris case, which I might point out was a case I'm familiar with because it was my case. But in Harris, he had a gun up in the sunroof, or stuck in the sunroof. It was, and this court...
And it wasn't visible in the driver, and it was kind of up and behind the driver?
Well, that was a matter of contention, but as it turned out, it wasn't... This court found that the circumstantial evidence was insufficient in Harris, and the Minnesota Supreme Court agreed. But here, this defendant had much more actual behavior vis-a-vis the marijuana.
You had DNA too, right?
Well, there was DNA in Harris, but Mr. Harris was not a main contributor, which I don't know the exact language, but one of the bags here, Sims, was the main contributor.
And 95% of the rest of the world could be excluded, right? And Harris was a different, the DNA was not as close a match.
It wasn't as close a match. None of them could be excluded, and 75% of the population could be excluded. Also here, there was a smell of marijuana in the car, and there was marijuana in front of Mr. Sims on the floor of the car, which he tried to cover up with his feet. So you've got behavior, explicit behavior on the part of Mr. Sims, indicating that he knew there was marijuana in the car, which you didn't have in Harris. And also there were like five or six air fresheners right there on the driver's side near Mr. Sims, all of that suggesting that he was aware of the fact that there was marijuana in the car. Unless this court has other questions, the state would ask that Mr. Sims' conviction be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The appellant wish to use your 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thanks. I just want to clarify one thing. Respondents' counsel stated that there was a scale in this case. I don't remember a scale being involved. I think there was a marijuana grinder. I just wanted to make that clear because I think that goes in indicia of sales.
And grinder, as I look at a bunch of these cases, grinder is something that is used by someone who's using marijuana.
Yes, and that's one of the points I was going to make. It's used for personal use, and it kind of corresponds to the marijuana leaves being on the floor when the police came up and saw them, and, you know, someone might have been using for personal use at that point. I want to go back to the order of the counts. The instructions here were confusing. You have this general instruction saying, you know, don't read into any of this about the order, and then they give a specific order. This case is like Johnson, which is that unpublished case I stated, and I know it's unpublished, but in Johnson, this court reversed on this issue because of the confusing nature of the instructions. And in Johnson, that same instruction was given about the general order. This court still reversed. So that's one factor in the way courts look at whether these instructions are error when, or whether they're harmful. So I don't think it's dispositive that, you know, the court instructed with that general instruction. I did check the record quick. I know that on page 142 of the transcript, it was asked, and did you weigh each of the individual packages? And she said yes. And then there, I didn't see any indication that there was weighing of the whole bunch. And also the lab report doesn't give...
Is that one of the exhibits?
Yeah, it's exhibit 38.
Thank you.
Exhibit 38 lists, you know, all the 28 baggies measured in their each individual quantities, and it doesn't even give like a an aggregate amount at the end. So that, to me, that indicates that they were, you know, measured individually. The 95% confidence, again, I just don't think that amounts to proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think, to convict someone just based on a percentage number like that, I don't think that's what the law is.
What about the experts' kind of other way of expressing it, saying that the measurement is accurate to within 0.005 grams? Does
right.
that get closer to saying to meeting proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
It's closer. I think, you know, what counsel stated was she highlighted the word slightly, and she said it might deviate slightly. And what the testimony was it wouldn't deviate 2 grams, but it might deviate slightly. And I guess that's for the jury to decide what slightly means. Does slightly mean 0.193? Or, you know, does it mean, or, you know, it didn't mean 2 grams, but it could have reached out. The jury could have determined that slightly meant here that it was, you know, 0.193, and that it was exactly 42.5 grams. If there are no more questions, I would ask this court to reverse Mr. Sims' conviction based on the sufficiency of the evidence. And in the alternative, I would ask you to reverse and remand for a new trial. Thanks.
Thank you. The matter is submitted. We will issue our decision within 90 days, and we thank counsel for your briefing and argument.